Welcome to the Not Sorry Art Podcast. I'm Sari Shrike, the artist and creator behind Not Sorry Art. I'm so excited to talk art and creativity with you, so grab a drink, grab a snack, and let's dive in. I also wanted to say that today's episode is sponsored by my book. I have a book coming out. I'm so proud of this, guys. The links are already up. I'll have them in the show notes. But the book is called Modern Still Life, From Fruit Bowls to Disco Balls. It is my take on a step-by-step painting book. I am really excited about it. Not only does it have like motivational tips and tricks to keep you going in your practice, but it also has clear and beautiful and full color breakdowns of the step-by-step process in my paintings. So I could not be more excited about it. If you wanted to check it out, pre-order it. It would help me more than you even know. Hello, welcome back to the Not Sorry Art Podcast. I'm Sari. Thanks for being here. I'm really excited for today's show as I'm kicking off our second annual summer book club series with my friend, cultural insights expert, Megan E. Collins. We started this book club in 2023, and it is back by popular demand. Megan and I will be discussing three books this summer, one in June, July, and August. This month's pick is W. David Mark's 2022 book, Status and Culture, How Our Desires for Social Rank Creates Taste, Identity, Art, Fashion, and Constant Change. Megan and I really enjoyed this book, and I highly recommend it for readers looking to take a deeper look at hierarchies in our society and how status tiers inform cultural capital. In our conversation, we hone in on how status and culture applies to modern day internet culture. And of course, we discuss the applications of the book to people who are in the art world. I hope you enjoy our conversation. And if you're reading along with us, please let us know your thoughts on the book in the comments section or in a podcast review. Next month, we'll be reading Your Brain on Art by Susan Magsalmon and Ivy Ross. So stay tuned for that. And as always, happy creating. Hi, everyone. Welcome. I could not be more excited for the first book of our summer book club series. I am here with one of my all-time favorite humans, the smartest person. I love picking your brain. We are here with Megan E. Collins. She's a cultural insights expert and just an all-around very smart, intelligent, fun person to talk to. So first, thank you. Welcome, Megan, for being here.
Thank you for having me and for those kind words. You're also one of my favorite people to chat with, and I'm so excited to talk about this book with you.
Yay! Awesome. Oh my gosh, so kind. I love that. Yes, and today we're talking about a book that I feel like is very pertinent to all things internet. I know this is a podcast for artists, a lot of visual artists, but I feel like as artists, in addition to whatever our medium is, status and culture is another one of our the things that we're playing with as artists. So I will get into why I think this is a good book for artists more into the podcast. But without further ado, this is Status and Culture, How Our Desire for Social Rank Creates Taste, Identity, Art, Fashion, and Constant Change by W. David Marks. I love this book. I'll full disclosure, I'll just say, I have to share my bias from the top. I read this book. It was recommended to me after I read Pierre Bourdieu's Distinction. And by read, I mean trudged through and listened to a lot of YouTube lectures to try to understand what I was reading. But somebody recommended this as a good modern contemporary analysis on this. Basically, he breaks it down and makes it a little more, I would say, digestible for the layperson. And it definitely did that. I feel like, you know, I want to hear your thoughts, but like if I can start from the top, I read this book as a persuasion that these things exist and that they matter. And I feel like that's a good place to start because a lot of times pointing out status and culture is very off-putting to people. And it's for two reasons. I think anyone who falls under the umbrella of like in some way a little insecure about their class and status position, followed by anyone who sort of personally values everyone should be treated equally, that sort of ethos, anyone who falls in either one or both is going to I think bristle at the idea of status and culture. So AKA almost everyone. So
yeah,
I'm curious about what you thought of the book and how you would describe it.
Yeah. Well, I'm reading this book because you recommended it even before we were going to do this summer book club series. You told me to read it and I looked at it and I was like, this is exactly right up my alley. And I completely agree with you that it's definitely kind of an argument that these things exist. For me, it was cool because this is what I do for work all day and every day is I kind of read all of these things that the unseen forces, the grand mystery of culture that he talks about and like try to help other people understand. So for me, this was like Not necessarily like new information, but it was just so like fun to read. And just, I felt like I was having a conversation with him and I was, you know, highlighting and making notes, and I would like make a note. And then a few paragraphs later, he would get to that point and I'd be like, this is like, we're in conversation. Like he's totally speaking my language. And I think I'll refer back to this book. Like there's a few that I have that I just keep referring back to. And I think this will be one I refer back to forever. So thank you for introducing me to it.
Yes. Yeah, of course. No. And I feel like it's a good textbook. You know, it's like you said, it's a good reference point. And it really is, I think, written in the essence of like creative writing. It's kind of convincing someone, which is, I think, you know, the job of something like this. But it got me to thinking, like, why in the year 2020, I think it came out last year, so 2023, is it so late and we're only just now, I feel like, getting some of these more seminal books that say, here's the state of status and culture. And I was thinking about it, and there's this like saying about how, you know, the most taboo things to bring up are, what is it, religion and politics. And not to say those aren't taboo, but rather I would say, and again, this is a bias as someone who makes visual art about class and status, that class and status and taste are actually kind of more of our taboos, at least maybe the younger generations. And by that, I just mean like millennials and under, roughly, that it feels like anytime I've gone online and talked about this, and the internet is like known for like misunderstanding, and that's fine. It comes with the territory. But if I talk about status and class, usually the first thing that's pointed out is like, oh, you're obsessed with status, or that it's a shallow sort of thing. And I think what I want to make as an argument before we really start diving into the book from my own personal experience is it's one of those things where when you're not only status neutral, which is a concept that Marx talks about in the book, I think he has like a graph for it that's actually pretty good, illustrates it, where it's like you have status climbing, you know, all the way up to high status, but then you have people who are at a class deficit. They're not even able to meet, I always think of like basic as the term, you know, you know, if someone's basic, it's that they can't afford to go to Starbucks and get pumpkin spice latte. They can afford the Lululemon, you know, the most basic type stuff. But if you've ever lived below that, where like those things aren't even achievable to you, it's status can be the way you earn back humanity that is lost to you. And so I guess what I want to say is like, for anyone starting this out, like this isn't a discussion about like, how do we get perceived as better than we are? Or, you know, it isn't like ego chasing, that unfortunately we live in a society where not everyone is granted basic human status. And I think for me personally, it's my interest in why not, and why is culture, you know, completely dictated by running away from those who do not have status, and how that completely fuels the trend cycle. And so that's where my curiosity is. And I will say, when I close this book and I go live my life, I'm not calculating status. It's like that one, was it Black Mirror episode where it's like
Black Mirror, yeah.
Yes, it was called like Nosedive, I think.
Nosedive, yep.
Oh my gosh.
And with Bryce Dallas Howard. We reference this so much in trend forecasting, yeah.
Yes, and I think it's a lot of our worst anxiety, seeing the whole nosedive thing happen. But it's really, there's some, you know, you walk away from this and you go live your life and you do have your own taste, and maybe it's status and maybe it's not. I don't think you always have to be morally weighed down by status and culture. I think what I would encourage people, whether you're an artist or a layperson or anything in between, is to walk away with an understanding that when people are doing the cultural investigation around status and culture, that it's less of an ego task, or at least I would hope so. And it's more of a trying to understand how we can sort of, I don't know, it's relate to each other, find some common humanity. And that's where I think some of the investigation lies.
Yeah, it was actually funny. In reading this book, I was less against the kind of the nosedive type technology than I've ever been before, because he kind of lays out that like some of this is just very much human nature. And I was seeing that like a lot of the problems and issues and kind of that loss of humanity that you're talking about don't actually come from status seeking itself, but like the ways that we then use that to kind of demean others, and the metrics by which we give people status, I think aren't necessarily right now the most pro-social, pro-human. But if they really truly were in a world like the nosedive thing, where it really is just like, are you nice to people? Like, you know, like you, I could see the value in some sort of thing like that. I don't actually want it to happen, but I was like, this book actually kind of made a case for that, you know?
Yeah, no, it's like the subjective versus the objective. You know, it can
Yeah.
be very like gaslighty when it's like you know, it's you're born into it. You have these connections. It's these undue privileges, and then being blamed for status seeking. You know, if you don't have those things. No, I completely agree. Like that's, and I think, you know, from my own personal experience, that's always been my thing as like a little kid who's been like intimately aware of this. Maybe not on a conscious level, but subconsciously as a kid. You know, if you've ever been too poor to participate in any trend, like you think about this, whether or not you're using, you know, Pierre Bourdieu's distinction and his habitats and all those like philosophical sociological terms, you're aware of this sort of thing. But I completely agree with sometimes it would be nice to have things to be more clear. But I think that's the labor behind reading a book like this. And then, you know, even just thinking about it or making art about it. And that, I think that's what I'm hoping that if someone's listening to this podcast, like, I would love to see how this would inform someone's art. And I don't even just mean like making the art necessarily, but even like how you show up and how you create context for your own art. That's an idea that I share with my students all the time. It's like, as artists, you have to create your own context. Like, what does it mean that your art is being shown between a Razor ad and a Little Caesars ad? Like, context matters. And I think this book, you know, creates language to understand those sorts of things. I'm curious though, what are like some of your favorite, because the book is chock full of examples. It really is like, it takes you through all of these like quotes and examples and studies, which I love. Were there any that like stood out to you or that really are going to stick with you?
For me, I think this wasn't my first time hearing most of these like examples of like how things become popular in culture. But I think the one that I always love is the chocolate one, and just like how that became one of the first things of kids learned how to say in foreign languages because like they wanted chocolate, and it's just so wholesome. And like, you know, who doesn't love chocolate? And so I think just like, yeah, I would say that one was probably my favorite.
Yes, I love that. No, it's there's a lot of really, I think, cute moments in this book. But yeah, I mean, I also think like you were saying, there's wholesomeness to it. It doesn't necessarily mean that all status seeking is bad or negative. But I you know, to flip the script a little and go negative, I think, you know, because the book starts out kind of, I think I could see someone picking up this book, reading the first chapter and being kind of icked out. Like that was my fear, because I read this for my own pleasure. Like, you know, I think in January is when I read it. And then I read it kind of again with the lens of like, I'm going to be discussing this with Megan and with my audience. And so I ended up having this sort of pit in my stomach of like, oh geez, like people are going to think that I'm just concerned about like status and this negative kind of first two chapters of this book. But I think, it, you know, I'm glad he started out, because by the end of the book, he really was saying like, it's a natural human thing. And there, he did give a lot of like positive examples of status seeking and how it can drive creativity. And he made a really good argument for it. But if I can start negative, what I thought was really interesting is the association with like poor moral virtue or like an immorality to status seeking. One of the points he brought up was that etymologically, the origin of the word villain comes from a lower class peasant trying to achieve higher social standing. And it reminds me of like sumptuary laws, which are these laws that said, you know, that if you were a peasant and you tried to wear like a bright blue or a bright red or a green or certainly a purple, that dressing above your status was like an immoral thing, like the church frowned upon it. And I think that that was kind of an interesting, you know, how much of that still carries, because so much of this class stuff, I think in the United States, really falls contrary to our creed as a nation. Like all men are created equal. Now, obviously we know that and America has never been completely authentic with that claim, but there's this sort of, you know, I think the most optimistic among us and even amongst in our own selves, like we can say that we like to believe that we could eventually in the US like live up to that creed, that we all agree that that is something worth striving to. But it's interesting because what happens, I think, when you say, hey, we're a meritocracy, so your success, your status is a virtue of your, you know, your talents and being a good person. When we say that on the surface, but then you pull it back and you have all this sort of, I don't know, status seeking and, you know, all of the things that the book talks about, I just wonder, I'm just curious, I'd love to hear like what you and what other people like think of like that dissonance. Like, how do we make sense of that? Like, how is that? How do we, yeah, make sense of that?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of it is kind of like And that was something that I was thinking about the whole time I was reading the book, like chicken or the egg, like, are we seeking status because that's natural, or are we seeking status because we see that that's like pivotal to survival? And so this is a very real, like, ideological ecosystem that exists. But I also think it's hard to say, like, what are the reasons? So, like, we kind of back into a lot of these things. And like, even morality, I wonder how much of that is like us backing into morality is a way to police people and like what they do. And like, I would say, like, you could say we're moving away from that as a culture of like, you do the right thing just because it's right. And it's like, people are like, no, let's investigate that. Because if you think about it, like, is it really that moral for me to pay my taxes when like the like top richest people aren't, like, and yeah. when you think about it, like, a tax evasion that doesn't, it's not immoral, like, you know? So it's like, yeah, this weird thing that we kind of use morality as like a tool to police people, but do we actually value morality, you know?
Yes. I'm so glad you brought that up, because that, when I was reading the last couple chapters, rereading it, it reminded me of kind of these conversations that I see happening online. Like right now there's this creator, her name's Nara Smith. I'm sure everyone knows about her, but she's amazing. She's beautiful. She's like, I don't know, like amazing. She makes everything from scratch and she's very soothing, but it feels like every like 2 months, like the internet tries to cancel her for some reason. And what's interesting is like, I'm old enough to have seen this happen over and over again. Someone is kind of the star of the moment. They're the woman of the moment. And then we all kind of like look at our watches and say, and, you know, she's out of here. And I think part of that's because women tend to be commodified more than men. So men are allowed, you know, we see the anti-heroes on like The Sopranos. Men are allowed the space to be not perfect, I guess I'll just say that. And then with women, it's like this, you know, I think it's status seeking. I think it's this like wanting to take someone down a peg. What is the word? Schadenfreude? I think I'm like in really bad German. Mm-hmm. This idea that you want to take someone down a peg. And so I see this continue to happen, but where when I was a kid, it was simply by virtue of them being tacky or ugly or aging, or gosh, weight was always one. It was these sort of things that now we look back and say that that's morally repugnant to dislike someone for that. But I see the same exact thing, but to your point, with a different cloak on it of like immorality, mm-hmm, and people getting more mad. Like it feels like it's, to your point, like a disproportionate, the anger for the action doesn't match up. And I think that that's an interesting way, because at the very end of the book, he talks about that of like, hey, have we reached the stasis where morality drives a lot of the status seeking? And I guess I don't know, I don't have like a super hard opinion on it, other than I see it like instead of a real bid to contend with what does morality mean in 2024, but rather as like a guise for like the same old behavior that we have seen for years. I mean, decades, centuries, probably.
Yes, totally. And I think, and there's this other book I read called Memes to Movements, and it had an anecdote in there about like the Chinese government and how the rules are intentionally vague to, and then the punishments are intentionally over like severe, mm-hmm, to encourage people to be more conservative. So it's like the rule is vague. I don't know where the line is, so I'm going to err on the side of caution. And I think that that's kind of like something similar that we're seeing with like the way that we put, like, there's power in just the act of policing other people's behavior. And even that can be seen as a way to get status for yourself. Kind of like, if you see people are putting Nara Smith on a pedestal and you can take her down, then that says that you have power as well, you know?
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. It's more
and
personal.
I think one of the few powers that the internet has as a collective is mass cancellation, like, yeah, for everybody at the same time to agree, like, we don't like this person. And so I think that's just an attempt to like exercise that power that they have.
Yeah. Like, it's almost, what is the, it's like a theory of like release valve theory, where it's like, people need to feel like they can do something. And it's a bummer because I've seen it be used for good, like over and over again. But it's interesting, mm-hmm, because like, you know, if you study, I forget what class I took, some like rinky dink 101 college class. But anyways, mm-hmm, we talked about the idea of, you know, whenever the Constitution and the Bill of Rights were all set up, you know, there was this idea of not wanting either king rule or rule by one religious sort of point of power. But equally, there was this real resistance, which is why we don't actually have a true democracy, of mob rule. And I always thought that that was a fascinating thing to learn in schools. Like, why did they fear mob rule? And I think it's interesting because I would have been, oh my gosh, it would have been like the early 2000s when I would have been learning this, or, you know, 2010s at most. And I had no context for what mob rule really looked like. And it's funny because now I see, we see sort of a version of mob rule, and we see it do so much good and at the same time be so wrong and miss the mark. And I, you know, a big existential question I have, and I have no answer and no inclination really, is like, well, what is, how do we begin to fine tune that a little? Like, I think that that's a fair goal, to be like, we can get it better. We can make it, we can get it on track somehow. I don't know. But like, what, I mean, I'm sort of asking rhetorically, but like, what even is, how do we get mob rule to get it right? Is it status seeking? Is that how we do it?
Yeah, that's so interesting. And yeah, to your point, right now we are kind of like in a mob rule like culture. And even when he talks about that towards the end with like the internet and stuff. But one thing about that is like, and as you were saying, when you look at what the masses are doing, it defaults to something that's very middle of the road, acceptable. And then there's not a lot of room there for like innovation or progress. And he talks about kind of feeling like we're in like a bit of a cultural stasis right now, which like, I don't know if I necessarily agree with, but I do think that we can say that when you look at the top culture that's getting the most like financial support, we are in a bit of a cultural stasis. Like if you look at the top films, they're all reboots, prequels, existing IP. And that's because there's kind of this hesitation from the decision makers to venture into experimentation and pushing the boundaries, because they're looking to appeal to as many people as possible globally. It's not even just like, oh, we want this to be really successful in America. It's like, no, globally. And what are the things that we as a globe can agree on? Like, very high level, like not a lot of like nuance there. So that's why we do see like at the top, there is a little bit of this cultural stasis.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think it's so interesting because when we thought of the internet initially, you know, oh, this great thing, we're going to connect each other. I think, and the book talks about this, that there was this real hope that it would be a cultural explosion. And what was the study? Someone mentioned the idea of a head and a tail. So the head is like, culture, it's your reboots, you know, your Avengers, your, you know, Taylor Swift's, you're just like the main culture up front. And then the tail would be all these like subcultures that would get progressively niche. And I think we've seen that, but I'm always really interested when it comes to creativity, because like creativity is one of those things I love studying. I wish there was more like science about it. I feel like right now we're all just like philosophizing, but creativity to me, you know, one thing I'm really interested in is in corporate. So not Japan entirely, but in the corporate sector of Japan, they're having what the government has coined a creativity crisis. So not, I wouldn't know, I'm not a cultural analyst, but they have self-determined that that's something they're struggling with. And a lot of what people are analyzing when this is happening is basically there's too much risk. There's too little risking. Creativity requires risk. That's a given. And when you don't have any safety nets, whether it's financially or culturally, the risk is not worth it. Like you only can do something if there's a certain guarantee. And anytime you move the needle of progress culturally, ethically, anything forward, you have to be able to have risk. And so when I see internet culture, I see a mixture of, you know, capitalism has made it to where you have to be very, very wealthy in order to sort of contend creatively on a certain capacity, at least what we used to think of, like, you know, being a full-time artist, you know, more traditional. Creativity is a dandelion growing through concrete. I do think it prevails. I think it grows anywhere. So I'm really hesitant to say like sweeping statements about creativity being lesser in some capacity, but, you know, in the more traditional sense, less working class, poor, middle class, even people are able to do creative fields in a more traditional way. And on the other side, I also think we live in a moment, again, with that mob rule sort of thing, where the internet, I think, as well-intended as it might be right now, has made it very risky for people, you know, socially to take risks. And I want to be careful because edgelords use that mindset a lot. And I think it doesn't mean you have to go full like incel and be like, you have to be able to say anything you ever want. But I think it's more that there needs to be an example. So I'm not just saying stuff, is like, what's her name? Charlie XCX just came out with an album. And one of the songs like mentions someone who is like, I think like far right Catholic, forget her name. She was like the info war girl. Do you know who I'm talking about? She drank, like, she's, oh my gosh, what's her name? She was being interviewed by InfoWars, and she told them that they had worms for brains. And anyway, someone listening is like shouting the name at me. Anyways, but she ended up going far right. All you need to know is that she's kind of this internet persona. She ended up going far right. Well, Charlie XCX had a song where she mentioned her. And when the album came out, there was this mild bubbling of cancellation because she mentioned her. Of course, Charlie XCX went and basically explained some nuance about how women are often used as villains. And, you know, I don't know that I even 100% got it. There did seem to be some space for her. I just think it's really interesting, you know, when I think about like, what is safety? What does risk look like for creatives? And how does that contend with our current culture, I guess?
Yeah. And that's even something that we talk about at work, of like the risk of putting yourself out there to become a creator. And I think that's part of what TikTok has done so well, or depends on who you ask. Like, there's good and there's bads, but like kind of taking this idea of echo chambers and leveraged it for psychological safety for creators, of like, when you're posting a video, you kind of trust that TikTok is going to put it in front of the people who want to see it. And there's kind of that trust in the algorithm there. And that's where you see kind of there being more productive, positive, like creative spaces where it's not like, let's critique if we even like this thing or not, and if this is worthy of consuming. And it's like, we've all consumed this, we like it, let's talk about it now. And I think algorithms like TikTok make that more accessible, where it's like, this is, if you don't like it, keep scrolling, is something people always say. And we're moving towards that culture of like, do you even need to interact with things that you don't enjoy or like? And that's something that critics are contending with right now. They're like, people don't really appreciate what we do anymore. Like, what is the role of the critic in a society where everything's super personally relevant and people only want to see the things that they enjoy and they like?
Yes. Yes. I think I've seen little bits of that conversation and I love it. Actually, there's a couple of like, I'm a long form YouTube girly. That's my, like, I like TikTok, but I only have, my only social media on my phone is YouTube. There was, I forget who it was. If I remember, I'll put it in the show notes, but somebody made a video essay about the death of like the negative review and how, like, I think what you were just saying, like everything has to be so immediate and so personal. And I'm hoping that, you know, you mention a lot pendulum swings, that we've reached an apex of like the bean soup parable, to say the least. Idea that somebody made a bean soup recipe on TikTok, and the first comment was like, well, what if I don't like beans? And like the slight bit of media training should tell you, okay, then maybe you keep scrolling and you find a different recipe. But it has become a parable of like a lack of willingness to be like, not everything is for me. And to your point, I do think that is, as a creative person, a very exciting thing to see, that it's a little bit of like the algorithms can create some buffer for you to say things that are, you know, make art, say things, you know, digest someone's drama, whatever it is, in a way where it's not immediately, you know, thrown to like the worst side of TikTok. And then also people, I think, to their credit, being willing to have conversations around like that media literacy, you know, all the way from SEMA, literally digesting how to look at a picture, all the way to people being like, not everything's for you. And I love that.
And I think context is super important too. And like, I think that's one of the role of critics, of like giving you context that you might need about things. But I think now in this current era, we defer to fandoms and fans. Like, why do I care what this critic has to say just because they work for NPR? I want to know what Charlie XCX diehard fans who have been here since day one think about the album. Do they like it? And that's kind of seen as more of a marker of success than did it get this outside critical acclaim. But I also think that critics have kind of done this to themselves by not taking like internet culture seriously earlier, and it kind of put them at a disadvantage. And I also see this something similar happening with the Grammys. I actually told one of my coworkers, if Chappell Roan doesn't win Artist of the Year at the Grammys won't mean anything to me anymore, because it's like, it would not be reflecting what is happening in culture that we can all so clearly see. Like, this is clearly the breakout artist of the year. She's great at her craft. She has a clear aesthetic. She's selling the records. She's meeting all of the supposed criteria for this. Yeah. But we see that these institutions have other goals in mind, and there's a lot of politicking behind the scenes, and we see things like Harry Styles winning Album of the Year over Beyonce. Yeah. And so I think that what that has done is kind of just chipped away at the integrity of institutions and critics to make these decisions, because for decades now, we've seen them making decisions that just are out of step with the reality that we're living, you know?
Yes. Oh my gosh. So well said. I'm like drinking in every bit of that. Yeah. I think you're so right. And I think, I mean, that's perfectly said. I think, you know, because to me, sometimes the internet, and I think it might just be like my age being like perfectly millennial. I'm like the exact age of like the public internet.
Yeah.
To me has always felt like a little bit, if I can use a metaphor, like everyone's being let out to recess and there's like no teachers. We're all out here doing our own thing. And, you know, there's obviously good and bad that comes with that. And I think what's happened is like a lot of people have like sort of, you know, pushed away these like more, you know, Pitchfork critiques. What is it? The movie critiques, you know, just like some of these more traditional sort of institutions, to your point. And I feel like mm-hmm. right now we're finding that like, well, we do need that voice or that curation, that it's yes. not that we don't like curation. We just want the curation to be up to our new standard that we've like Lord of the Flies ourselves into like a new totally. Hierarchy. And now we want
yes.
our critiques to match that energy. I mean, I'm just at parroting what you said in like a, you know, my own way, but no, like, I think you're 100% right on that. And it reminds me of like one of my critiques of the book is like, he mentions standums, and you know how when someone's wrapping up a book and you're like, that could have used a whole nother chapter, but I get that you're trying to wrap up a book. I would kill for a book that was just, how do standums fit into like the status seeking? And obviously you'd pitch it in some other way, but like, I would love to see that more fleshed out, because he briefly touched on BTS Army. And I think if you wanted to understand the internet in the last 5 years, you would deep dive fandoms. Like that would be the gateway into understanding the internet.
Well, check out YouTube Culture and Trends Report whenever it's available to the public, because it is all about, the first chapter is all about fandom. So you're going to love it.
Oh my gosh.
I'll let you know when it's out. So if it's out before this is out, we can link into the show notes. But I was literally in a presentation today. That was just my coworker, Kaylee, gave a whole presentation on this today. And I completely agree. And that was also kind of in line with one of my critiques of this book, of that I think that he talks about status as if it is real, as opposed to like a human invention and a human like thing that we've decided is real. But it's also something that has changed so significantly in the past 10 years, like you were saying, that I was like, some of this just isn't as universally true anymore. And what he would talk about as status for like the first half of the book, to me, was reading as very like white, patriarchal, American, consumerist, like these were status as defined by that. And I think what you're hitting on with fandom is that it's like so much different now, and kind of the metrics by which we measure it, or like what we're looking to do. But he did talk about kind of like local versus global status. And I think that's so applicable to fandom and stand-in, because, and how it's like, it's kind of like an alive thing, because take like Taylor Swift, for instance. Yeah. It was not cool to like Taylor Swift for a very long time. Yeah. And if you were like a Taylor Swift fan, like pre- like 2018, I would say,
then
it was like not cool. You were not cool. Whereas now, if you've been a fan since then, you have like huge global status and huge local status within the fandom, because you're a diehard fan. So it's kind of like fandom is new space, where if you can't find global status, you're like, well, I can get local status within my fandom. I can be like a huge stan. I can have friends within my fandom. I can have community, and you can enjoy global status just by liking something. You can enjoy local status, like high local status, just by participating and engaging. And the rules are so much clearer there than in a space like the whole world, you know?
Yes, yes, yes. Especially, you know, I live in like small town Texas. I mean, I'm a little outside of Austin, so it's not truly the middle of nowhere, but it can feel like it. And it's funny because you do have such, like, I always have such a heart for like one particular brand of person, which is like the y'alternative person, which is always like, it's, you know, it very rural, and you'll see a family out to dinner and everyone looks pretty stereotypical middle of Texas, you know, I'm not saying good or bad, but just what you'd picture. And then one of the kids is like full dark emo, like, you know, and I think I think, you know, an experience of being any kind of alternative in a place that really is values homogeny and actually like leans into it as sort of like the book kind of talks about this, like as like a badge of like resistance to sort of liberal coastal elite culture. There's sort of, I think there would be more progress, but it's like the regression is a sign of, you know, their local status or whatever. Anyways, but I see, you know, I see someone like that. And I just like, you assume that like, well, that person has like an internet, you know, everyone does to some degree, but like that they're probably finding their community in online spaces. And I know that's not exclusive to that person. It's just, I see that person a lot, but it's, you know, I wonder, for me, I guess what ends up happening is I'm seeing all the status and culture and the books and how everything's moving towards the internet and how that's becoming richer. And, you know, not to be kind of like an old person, but I always get kind of worried, especially with like children, of like, well, how do we like bring the richness that we're finding in these internet spaces into the real world? What will that look like? Is there going to eventually be a dam break, or is we're moving into this like, you know, this dystopian where you only have a life online, or, you know, they what is the movie? Don't Worry, Darling, I think kind of had that energy to it. But yeah, I mean, I guess that's a lot of what I think your job has overlap with, but like, how do we bring that richness, you know, into real life?
Yeah. Well, I would argue that richness has always existed in real life. It's just who has access to it is different in real life versus on the internet. And this is kind of what he talks about, like what we would call like barriers to entry, but it's like, I think it's like access costs, I think that he calls it. Or yeah. So it's like, I think that the thing about the internet is that right now, currently, because it's for the most part free, I mean, you have to have a device to access it on and all of that. But it's just, do you have the time to spend on the internet? Have you been able to find your community, that type of thing? And so I think that who has high status on the internet is different than who has high status in real life. And what I've actually noticed is that people who are really high status in real life don't really engage with the internet. They don't really care. They maybe have like a private Instagram where it's like just their friends and family. But I think that, and obviously some people are just interested because they are, and there's, you know, exceptions to every rule. But I actually think that like high status people are actually going to opt out of the internet and like having an online persona in like the next few years.
Yes. No, I completely agree. I remember feeling the first like shift towards that. I forget how many years ago it would have been. Like, I was in my old house, so it would have been like 2017, 18, 2019. Ed Sheeran had an interview and he was like, I don't have a phone. And then everyone, of course, it made all the headlines. And then you click to like figure out what this means, because how do you not have a phone? And he has an assistant who has a phone. You know what I mean?
So
he has to check his email sometimes. But, you know, but that, I, you know, for me, I feel like that was, yeah, I mean, I think that's where we're going, is the flex is that you have some space. And I mean, I'll even say to myself, like, I have like a work iPad and then my cell phone, like even that is its own sort of luxury. And I, you know, I think the more books are going to come out about like, hey, screen time is not always great. And I think sometimes they flatten out because, you know, what the reality is, because you always have to have a boogeyman. And, you know, and I think it is a good boogeyman. I mean, every, you know, white terrorist attack in the United States, like, oh, not every, but a lot of them, it's like, oh, they had like this deep online incel personality, you know? So it's a very good boogeyman to have, you know, to be able to sort of gesture towards the internet and say it's bad. But I mean, we've done this before culturally. Like, it's like with diet culture, it's like, oh, it's, what is it right now? It's like seed oils or something. There's always like a boogeyman. And it's like, there are these larger, more nuanced conversations about access to food and how rest and stress are all part of a human's health. But instead of contending with breaking down the system of capitalism, we find a new boogeyman and we sort of point at it and we never actually make any progress.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about the chapter on art, because I'm, you know, I could and openly rant about status and culture forever, but I really want to be able to have this be a useful tool for, you know, for visual artists. And so there were, luckily the chapters about kitsch and art, I felt like, amongst other things, were really pertinent. I had a thought, I scribbled down a bunch of thoughts when I was reading it this time around. And one of them is about kitsch. And kitsch is a very gendered word. It kind of, it means like, you know, he defined it sort of as like low taste. It's like the lowest hanging fruit, the lowest common denominator. It's like the thing that everyone's going to instantly find. Like a good example is like a Thomas Kincaid poster. Those are really popular in like the 90s and 2000s. It's these little pictures of like little, what are the cottages and lights. you know, very obvious things. And I remember, I forget what article I was reading, but it was talking about how like women artists are always rated lower, even if the art is identical. There was like a study that came out in 2019 that had that, and they like tested people, and even women were prone to this bias. And, you know, it kind of got me thinking how the thing I wrote down was women make kitsch until you prove otherwise as artists, or I think in a lot of other fields, but like you, what you have made is sort of presented at like surface level until you prove that there's a higher level of thinking, where a lot of times male artists are granted a higher level of thinking, even if sometimes I suspect that maybe there isn't a higher level. And I'll point to one more example for this. It's also like this in comedy, where comedy sort of—
I was just going to say, I was going to say, this is like when I'm on a date and I make a joke and they think I'm don't understand something. And I was like, no, that was actually very funny joke that I just made.
You just have to assume that I'm operating on a separate plane, which you're not granted as a woman a lot.
Prove it. Yeah.
But that's like, that's more context that you have to make for your art, and it often waters it down. Like having to have that third layer of awareness is like, it makes what you're doing clunkier, and, you know, it's less, and, you know, and I feel like a lot of that is because, like, you know, kitsch in the art world is also sort of synonymous, or at least has overlap with like women's work, or like, what is it called? Craft. You know, there's this idea of like this utilitarian, like needlepoint, or, you know, making quilts, or certain kinds of ceramics have this utilitarian. And it's like, what you make is simply what you make. And like a woman at their best, and I'm not saying everyone believes this, I'm saying this is an undercurrent that a lot of other female artists have picked up on, but what you make is like at best a good example of your skill. And you have to like really prove that there's like some higher level thought going on, you know, and then the way you prove that, again, gesturing towards the book, is someone else has to sign off on it. And so I feel like the onboarding for women artists, you know, the whole why are there no great women artists, is because you have to jump through 10 extra hoops to even stand where a man is already granted in the art world. So anyways, I thought that was I don't know, that was my takeaway with the chapter.
Yeah. No, that really struck me too. I highlighted it. He said, artist is not an occupation. It's an honorific title. It's something that it's bestowed on people. And I feel like that's actually thinking that you've helped me kind of undo and unpack of like, this yeah. art, that is art. This is creativity. That is creativity. It doesn't have to be like in the Louvre for it to be considered art. And some of the stuff that's in the Louvre that's considered art back in the day, maybe was just considered more utilitarian, like you were saying. So I think that this is, like we were saying, it exists in comedy and exists. It's more of a reflection of a gender bias. I would say that anything that then status, it's reflected in how we view status and how we view art. And the whole time I was doing this book, I was thinking of that viral TikTok sound right now with Kamala Harris. So she's like, you think you fell at a coconut tree?
I love that.
You exist. And I think
the world that defines you. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes, you exist in the context of everything that came before you. Yeah. And yeah. I think that because we don't, like, I think that is imbued in women's, like, let me start over. We live in a culture where women are made to understand the perspective of men, and men are not made to understand the perspective of women. Yeah. And so we can understand the context of everything that came before us when it comes to men, and they just have not been tasked with that at all for women. And so it's really just like a misunderstanding of women that has been somehow rebranded as like men are just better, when it's really just like, no, they just don't understand men at all. And they don't see the value in the labor and the work and the artistry. And even like this idea of like cachet. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was very much like women's work and like community building. And like all of that is like, we see as kind of just something that just happens because we view things through a male perspective. But it's not something that just happens. It's something that women put a lot of time, effort, thought, conversation into, but men don't really care about it until they can see how it can improve their status, make them richer, have some benefit for them.
100%. And a perfect example of this was actually something I wrote down in the book on the chapter on art. And it was when they were talking about Jackson Pollock, and I believe it was a female gallery owner, but she referred to him as pure because he was lazy and sporadic and ill-tempered. But anyways, that he was lazy and sporadic and ill-tempered. And she basically said that it, that he was more pure because he didn't have to sort of curate himself, and he was like a raging drunk and he like stole from his wife, and sort of the like the more ill-tempered he was, the more that it added to his cachet because it fit this narrative, which I think is largely just like we've excused this from it. You know, men were the only ones who were able to even partake in art, so okay, you get these like wild, you know, Jackson Pollock-esque artists, and women build the cachet, or the rest of the world sort of does the work of bridging the gap and building the cap, you know, where a woman on the other hand would have to show up and be so, you know, jump through the hoops, and there'd be like this mixture of both prim and proper but not too stuffy, and it's like an impossible, and it's just not realistic. But I don't know, I thought that was a really interesting kind of point in the book, where it's like, it's, you know, is it the work, is it the art? Rarely in the art world is it actually just that the art is so fantastic. And I think that that's like the biggest heartbreak for people. Mm-hmm. I think we want to believe that it's fair and that the cream will rise to the top. And that's the bread and butter of the meritocracy, right? You know, it's the thing where, and I even know that I believe it on some level. You have to, because if not, you lose hope and you can't lose hope. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to believe if I make the right work, it'll happen. It'll turn out. And I will say the one thing in my career that's really backed that up for me is the internet. And again, as much as the internet is painted as this like, you know, boogeyman, and I think it's like anything, you need to be aware and treat it with gloves and be careful with it. But the internet is where I have found the most, like, even with algorithms, like there's a little bit of like, if you make really good work, even if everything else about you doesn't fit into the art world, good work does, talent, skill has, you know, storytelling, all of those things that make good art is going to gain traction in some way. Is it going to be the most viral thing ever? No, but if you consistently do it, and it's not just me saying this, like, you know, and granted, consistency is not always for granted. And I know I'm glossing over some stuff, but I see little pockets of that, like us living up to our creed, but it's certainly not everywhere in the art world. And I would say the art world in some cases, perhaps I am biased, is actually like a really bad example of a true meritocracy. I think it really lives up to more neoliberal ideals than a lot of industries.
Yeah. Going back to what you were saying about Jackson Pollock and kind of like the way he behaved too, something I was thinking about is he talks about in the book, this idea of conventions and how things become like, this is a convention of like, this is just how we do things. Like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but for example, like Christmas trees become a convention of the holiday season, right? And we don't really even know why we do that, but it's like synonymous with. And I was thinking about, okay, well, like who became artists back in the day? Like who... like was like, I'm going to shirk everything and not do what my family had planned for me. I'm going to spend all my time like painting and do like, and I don't care if anybody likes it, I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the type of guy like Jackson Pollock, who, that doesn't mean that there weren't people who maybe had the talent and could have created amazing works at that time, but they didn't have those opportunities to just like explore their work because their personality type didn't allow for that. And so then it becomes this convention that like, oh, like male artists are just geniuses who are just like these people and these beings who need to be left to their own devices, when really that's something, a convention that we've backed into just based on who has had success with this. And I think the internet and my experience with artists is like, I've only met like female artists who like are really kind and have jobs and careers and lots of friends and interests and hobbies and are super accepting and welcoming. So that convention could one day change, but they're very persistent. And especially with something like the art world that is so like industrialized now.
Yes, I love that. Yeah. And I think it really, that's perfectly said. I think, it, you know, the idea of this brooding male who's like not good at the social stuff, but it justifies, it's such a, it's actually one of my least favorite tropes. I can't stand that trope. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because like, I want to bring this up with you because I actually think it's one of the tropes that Taylor Swift struggles with. I'm bringing this all back to Taylor Swift. I find her so interesting because I think she has the potential to have such good, important, needed, nuanced conversations around women artists and legacy, because we don't have great women artists are rare. And I don't think it's because women talent is rare. I'm obviously do not think that, but I think what ends up happening is, yeah, well, you are exactly what you're saying. Like the who becomes great and mythologized is men. It's the convention. And I think the trope of sort of the male genius, regardless of the industry, being sort of antisocial, it feeds into itself. And what has ended up happening, and I've seen this because like my other job is teaching, right? I teaching and making art. That's kind of what I do. And, you know, given my background and all this stuff, like I naturally kind of, this is going to sound like a humble brag, but I don't mind giving. It turns out in the art world, you have to be a little more smoke and mirrors with your stuff. I didn't know that until all the way through my career. So I'm at a point now where I love it. I don't mind. I give, I share, I give. And what I found is that it's not how it impacts the work. It's the act of sharing and how that's antithetical to the convention of being sort of this brooding male. And obviously women can embody the brooding, the antisocial, you know, in an attempt to replicate what that success looks like. And where the Taylor Swift of it all plays in is I think she's obsessed with the idea of like, if men can do it, why can't I? I really think that like, yes, that's her other 13, you know, I think that's, she's got it on her arm. And I think what's happened is I always think of it like this, you know, cause I think of this a lot too, the white woman conundrum of like, what is white woman feminist? And it's very one anyways, but I think like we need more women being just as bad as men in fiction. In fiction, I think we need to see them be villains and just as awful. I think in reality, the real question, and something I don't think we're equipped to do as a culture, but I know it's the right direction, is we need to limit what male success looks like. Because right now, it's driving capitalism and it's killing people. Like, not to be dramatic, not really dark.
Yeah, but it's very literally killing people.
Yeah, it's violent and it's terrible. So I think, you know, she has such a position where she could redefine what success looks like. And I know she's always going to see it as like, well, why me as the woman, do I have to give up the, but I think she could transcend gender in that instance. Cause I think she transcends a lot and she could say, no, this is what success should look like. Full stop. I'm going to call on my male counterparts to not keep rigging the charts so that they can win some pointless metric because they want to impress Paul McCartney. Like it should be, you know, there could be she has the power to have some really important, I think, conversations. And I think she is up against a lot as far as like convention of what a legacy artist is, but I think she could use it to like re-establish convention. If anyone could do it, it would be her.
I completely agree. And I could do a whole 2 hours on Taylor Swift and all of that. But I do think though that like, Taylor Swift is also a good example of this global versus local like status. And I think that her local status is not what we think it is. Like I saw a video that was like, Taylor Swift is a dork. Like she's not cool. Like other celebrities don't want to hang out with her. And I was like, yeah, like I could see that. You know what I mean? Like based on like the interactions that we see in the paparazzi walks and the way that her squad was very much a contrived marketing scheme. Like, so I think that actually a lot of Taylor Swift's perception of her own status comes from this topping of the charts and comes from her ability to make money. And obviously with her fans, they love her artistry and she would have the power to change things. But I actually do think like among her peers, that is her power. I think she feels powerless against these conventions. Whether or not that's accurate, I don't actually know. But from my outside perspective, and then also having a little bit of purview into the way the industry works, I think that she does not recognize her own power. But I also think it's because she's surrounded by people who she doesn't feel like she has as much power over, or like is more powerless than we think. And so I really believe her that she thinks that she's like some feminist sticking up for things, because in the circle she runs in, it is a really big statement. But in the grand scheme of the world and in the internet and feminism, it's actually not. And it's all very middle of the road. But I also think maybe this is a good thing. Maybe it's good that we have such a palatable version of feminism, because then people in middle America who are super Republican and don't subscribe to any of that are like, okay, well, I can deal with Taylor Swift. And that does shift kind of like the Overton window a little bit. But I think people like you who are artists and people like me want that radical shift. And we want people who are in those positions to like push boundaries. And we talked about TriXCX, but I think there's tension there, both in the media and from what we hear behind the scenes. Right. And I think one of the most interesting things that Charli XCX did with this album is she has a song called Girl So Confusing, where she talks about her kind of fraught relationship with Lorde. And then Lorde came on the remix and they did they did it together and kind of squashed their beef, essentially. And I was like, this is art, not because the song is so good, but it is. I like the song a lot, but because she's making a larger statement about pitting women against each other and what that looks like. And she's letting us into the process. And I was like, this is really cool. And this is pushing the narrative forward. But this album is not number one, it's number three. And I think like there's a reason for that, you know?
Yeah. No, that's a good point. And I think, yeah, the idea of the Overton window and that's the thing. I think sometimes, especially in like more artistic spaces, I think that's where it answers one of my questions that I have on here, which is like, there's a real resentment of having, it's like, when it comes to like culture and progress, I feel, and I'm totally condensing this and simplifying it probably to an egregious amount, but like in the name of progress, if we do believe that the arc of justice, you know, the arc of progress bends towards justice, which I hope, optimistically. I think of a lot of times I have this feeling of like resentment towards like middle America, like pick it up, you know, this idea of like having like this begrudgingness of having to appeal to them. But I think it exactly sort of, you know, it encapsulates like what I consider the convection oven of this whole thing, which is like this running away from like this like lower middle class America, you know, constantly sort of cycling through, like, you know, this resentment, I think, that ends up coming from the slow adopters. I think in a more compassionate book, he sort of, because I think what ends up happening is when you present status, a natural question is like, well, why are they so far behind? But, you know, as you study trends and research, you do just have a group of people for all kinds of reasons, whether it's like geographically being far away from things, whether it's like coming from a culture that values, you know, trepidation and cautiousness over the risk of creativity or whatever. But you do have this group of people who are the slow adopters. And I think, you know, the cycle ends up coming, I don't know, it ends up being fueled by that sort of resentment, I think, of having to constantly pander, you know, to that people. And I feel compassionate for them in some ways, because I, you know, I grew up in the Ozarks and live in Central Texas and my parents, so I'm, you know, I'm of the cloth. But, you know, anyways, I think it's interesting. Do you in your work have any, like, how do you address sort of the slow adopters? Are they sort of like an afterthought, or is it like a conscious part of like trend predicting, or like how much is that part of your conscious thought?
Yeah. So basically, usually, and because I typically working with brands, they're coming to me because they want to be cool, they want to appeal to Gen Z and young people and more progressive people. So in my line of work, slow adopters are kind of an audience we just don't want to upset. We don't want to alienate. And so that's kind of the biggest thing of like, what is alienating to them? That said, I do think that like culture at large has come to the conclusion that some things are just going to alienate people, and we're not going to like, you're going to take that, like when it comes to LGBTQ issues, if your company celebrates pride, you're going to alienate people who are vehemently against that. But that's a pretty safe bet in terms of where culture is headed, that we are moving away from that. So I think reassuring the client that like, yes, some people feel this way, but I don't have the stats, so I'm not going to say it. I'll just say like a large percentage of Gen Z says that they're queer, and this is only going to continue to grow as a behavior. And that makes that risk feel more safe. So I think that I'm good with them making incremental progress, but I also, for me, it's less about like moving them along faster and more about not letting them add risk to situations that shouldn't have inherent risks to them. Like saying everybody deserves to love who they love shouldn't be that controversial of a statement, but it is in this context. And so that's kind of more of where I'm at, of less like, we need to make everybody vote for like Democrats, and we need like everybody to care. We all need to be soulless, because like, I'm aware that that's like just never going to be something that I'm going to be able to achieve in my lifetime. But how can I just like help make those little incremental steps? And I think that's why art is important, because it's emotion first. And so it kind of sidetracks all of those conventions and logic and really just makes you feel something. Because I think a lot of time people feel something before they have the words to articulate it. And a lot of times trends too. I was in a conversation about Barbie and they're like, what's this year's Barbie? And I'm like, nothing is this year's Barbie, because Barbie was the culmination of a movement. It was more than just a movie. It was like speaking to what everybody was feeling in that moment. And it was just a way to put words to kind of how people were feeling. And that's why it resonated. And that's what really great art does, in my opinion. It's not that it's the most successful, the biggest thing that everybody paid for. It's that it had a really deep impact on its intended audience, which I think Barbie did. It was intended for women who grew up playing with Barbies. Yeah. And we had a very like intense impact. It had a very intense impact on us. So that's how, kind of how, if I was going to give any advice to artists, not that I have any business.
No, I love it. Artists, yeah. No, it's great. You do too.
It would be to like choose who you want your audience to be and treat that as the group you want to have status among, because that's kind of what Taylor Swift did. She was like, I don't care what everybody says. I care about my fans. And like now she's kind of gone away from that a little bit as her fans have become basically everybody. But I think that that is what makes good art at the end of the day. And to your point about consistency, like keeping at that and continuing to like have that relationship with your core audience who you care about is important. And that's something I say too, of like, I've noticed that burnout comes in the creator space mm-hmm. when they're making content for an audience that they don't like. And I've noticed that they're real, like one of the things that creators love and is trying to say is like, I love meeting fans. Like I listen to this podcast called Giggly Squad, and she's mm-hmm. like, they always are like, oh my gosh, the girls who are gigglers are so cute. They're so cool. Like, and they clearly love like the positive feelings they get when they meet the people who are their fans. But if they were meeting people they didn't like, then that would lead to a lot of dissatisfaction with what they were making, you know?
100%. I'm like nodding vigorously if you're listening to this on the audio. I could not agree more. You know, consistency. And you're right, because burnout is always interesting to me, because I feel like sometimes people perceive it as like one lever of like, it's either forward or nothing. And you're so right. I think it's, you can do a lot more than you think if you're making an impact. And an impact can simply be mm-hmm. something like, I feel seen. My favorite, and you know, response from anyone, it can run a gamut, but if it's some iteration of I feel seen, whether it's I wanted to, now you made me want to go paint, or I had a childhood like that and it's crazy to see it like art, whatever that is. And the thing is, like, it is because of standpoint theory, which is, you know, kind of what you were talking about earlier, which is, you know, men aren't trained to listen to women's voices, and it can continue along, you know, not everyone's going to get everything. Anyways, the point is, if you're making for your audience, you know, and that's kind of what you're showing up and you're doing, and your audience could be big, it could be small. I mean, you may always max out at like not a very large audience, but you can do that kind of, I don't know, but not forever. I don't want to speak to anyone's, everyone's different, but you can do that for a lot longer than you think. And consistency really shouldn't be your enemy. Like if you're, to your point, if you're talking to the right people, you can ride that wave for a long time.
Yeah. And I would say even, I think at a certain point, appealing to the masses for people who truly want to innovate probably wouldn't feel good, because you'd be like, if this many people can get it, quote unquote, what you're doing, what you're saying is not really challenging convention. And I think artists want to challenge convention, and they want to push. And that's something they talked about in the book, of like music that doesn't necessarily sound good to your ears, but requires a deep knowledge of music and structure and music theory, and that those who like really know music get it. And so I think those type of artists, if they had a hit song, would be like, I did something wrong, if everybody's loving it. So I think it's like having a conversation with yourself of, where do I want to sit on this curve? Do I want mainstream success? Do I want to be a pop star? Do I want to be a pop artist? Or do I want like it to be these people? And is it really only ever going to be like, I kind of am like, I don't think I'll ever be like famous, but I think that like, I put content out there and I'm like, eventually I'll be kind of known among certain people, but not everybody. And it, you know, so it's like, you kind of have to decide where you want to sit. How far do you want to push things? Where do you want to break boundaries? And I think even edgelords want to be on the edge more than they want to do anything. And that's why they're always looking for that edge, even if it's like negative. Does that make sense?
100%. No, I think you're totally right. And it actually brings me to kind of what, like, the last things I want to say about this and wrap and, you know, finishing thoughts, because I think mm-hmm. it's perfect. Cause like, this is how I was ending the book. I was, you know, the last couple chapters, he was talking about sort of contemplative beauty versus consumptive beauty. And he references Kant a lot. And he basically, his whole thing was like, you know, do you act as an animal? You know, I remember reading about Kant in school, and it basically was like, do you just get up and your life is navigated the same way a dog is, where you just like wake up and you go find your food and then you find a spot in the sun and then you take a nap? Or do you resist that and lean into, in his case, he would say duty, in order to cultivate the ability to appreciate something that isn't just consumptive? And I actually think it's incredibly relevant now. While we aren't operating on a like the ethical, you know, the deontological ethical thing that Kant is selling, I do think the contemplative versus the consumptive is incredibly pertinent to like right now. And as far as the internet, my thought is like, I have this, like when he wrapped up the chapter, you nailed it perfectly when you said, like, it feels like he didn't like go deep enough, or he just like said, oh, it's the internet. And he didn't address the fact that it's this massive chasm shift, or like, you know, shift of like before internet versus after. My thought with the internet is very much a let it cook, which is perfect because it's an internet term, but I have a let it cook energy to the internet, because I think what we're doing is we're just starting, the people who've lived on the internet are just reaching an age and a hunger. And I don't even necessarily mean chronological age. I just mean like time spent on the internet, where we're starting to cultural omnivorism says that you appreciate both consumptive and contemplative beauty. Consumptive is just like, it's just objectively pleasurable. It's got sugar. It's like got dance moves, whatever it is. It's like easy to digest. And contemplative means you're sitting in a fandom, you're listening to these longer conversations, you're building up this robust amount of tolerance and insight and knowledge so that you can appreciate something that isn't obviously appealing to the masses. And what I think gives me hope in all of this, because it is hard to be an artist in this day and age, is I think we're about to actually see a renaissance. And that may not look like a capitalistic renaissance and like ticket sales or anything, but I think it's going to be a renaissance of authenticity, when I think we're going to, it's maturing. We're Lord of the Flying ourselves into a place where artists can have those deeper conversations to an in crowd who get them, whether it's a fandom that they're part of, their fandom, something in between. And it really gives me, I think, a lot of hope, you know, when it comes to what do I think this looks like going forward? I'm curious your thoughts about that.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And bringing it back to Taylor Swift, I actually think like authenticity has been her superpower, and part of why I didn't love this most recent album, because I feel like it was the most commercially minded, and I feel like it was missing some of that authenticity that, and I've heard other people say this too, like, I just don't believe her. Like, I don't believe what she's saying on these albums, or in these songs. And so I think that, as authenticity becomes less dangerous to people, as we're saying, like with the internet and even like privacy settings of like, I want to share this with everybody versus just my close friends. I think that as we're able to navigate this authenticity better, and then also have the internet has made status very visible. And he talks about how status is kind of this invisible force that we don't talk about, but we're forced to talk about it now. Yeah. And so I think that that will take away some of its power, and also just help us. We're never going to escape status, but I think we can be less kind of like slaves to it than we are now.
Yes. Yes. Perfectly said. No, I completely agree. I think awareness does take away its power. I know I've heard that in other contexts. Mm-hmm. But I completely agree. And that's why I think this is such a good book. I think, you know, tell your friends about it. It's one of those books I feel like that you can have on your nightstand and read like a little bit at a time, because it's just these little vignettes.
Totally.
Yes. So if you haven't read it and you're listening to this, like, I do think it's worth pushing through. Some books are best summarized. I think this one's a pretty good one to consume. But I hope it leaves everyone, you know, optimistic, aware of the tools at their disposal, and aware of, you know, what is status? It's a rigmarole. It's a, everyone's kind of running away from the lower middle classes, and then, you know, it's a cycle, and it doesn't have to feel like, you know, I think why I like stuff like this, if I can get back to like my most like vulnerable self, is it's like, there's this little version of me where it's like, why doesn't anyone want to play with me? Not, that sounds like world's smallest violin, but I think sometimes with status, we all have that. We all have moments of that, whether it's a minor social interaction or something online, or no one likes your art, or, you know, we all feel that. Mm-hmm. We've all felt that before. And I think when you realize how much status, and everyone's kind of do on their own little mission to you know, make themselves feel better, when you realize that that's actually what's at play, and it's not like some grave personal and maybe it is looking inward is a valuable skill, but and sometimes it's just status seeking. And I think that that can be a really helpful thing. Just to, it's like a weight off your shoulder. And I'm hoping that everyone listening feels that in some way.
Yeah. Well said.
Yay. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for being here. And I always love your insight. And I will say, share as much as you want with artists, because I think it's so helpful for artists to have, you know, critics are part of the ecosystem. I think writers are part of the ecosystem. I think people who analyze trends are part of the, so I'm always grateful to hear your thoughts. And I would encourage anyone listening, please follow Megan Virgo Like Beyonce on TikTok, and then Manicured Shelf on Instagram. She has the best book recommendations. You are like my personal librarian at this point.
I'm honored.
Yes, of course. Do you have any, where can people find you? Any final thoughts you'd like to share with the audience?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned all the places. I also have a podcast. I'm a little bit of a hiatus right now because I have a project I'm working on. But when I'm back in the swing of things, it's called Megan's Podcast, because there's no specific topic. It's just whatever's trending on the internet that week, and kind of doing what we did here and unpacking the deeper layers behind why that might be.
Yes. It's also hilarious, I have to say. I know it's hard to say yourself, but it's so funny. I love it. And it's gotten even funnier with like every episode.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Next month's book is Your Brain on Art. It's a bit of a shift in energy. It's really a feel good book. I've already read this book, full disclosure. The last one is the one that I'll be reading kind of live with everyone. But this book is, it's a nonfiction, but it's written pretty easy to consume, but it's basically an argument why we should all have art in our life. Everything from gardening, community building, humming, certainly to visual arts, how it helps us physically, emotionally. I'm really excited about this book. So I'm really excited to hear your thoughts. I know amongst all of your other facets of your personality, you host Still Life Nights with your friends and craft nights. So I'm excited to hear your thoughts. But yeah, thank you everyone for listening. We'll talk to you next month, and thanks for listening. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for being here. I wanted to also encourage you guys to leave a review. The feedback is incredibly helpful. And if you leave a review, I will read your handle or your name on the following week's episode. Take care, y'all, and happy creating.